Good evening. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober tonight and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Charlie for the honor and the privilege to be asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. That's always an honor for me, because for me it's a celebration of life, that one more day I've been sober by God's grace, by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, based on the 12 steps that I believe are spiritual in principle and honoring the traditions of this program. I'd like to welcome those of you who are new tonight to this program, and hope that you'll keep coming back with an open mind and join us. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, there is a reading in the back of the book, and it's entitled The Spiritual Experience. And at the end of that reading, it says, contempt prior to investigation will leave a man in everlasting ignorance. So when I arrived at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to listen to how it works, and the old timers in those meetings, which was 20 years and 10 months ago, told us exactly how it works, that you study the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you get a sponsor, you get into service, and you're guaranteed the promises. And if there's one thing I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you have never lied to me, because all of that has come true. By the time I sat in that first meeting on April the 9th, 1974, I was a winette. And in the book, in Chapter 3, More About Alcoholism, it explains the insane things we continue to do to keep from doing Step 1 and 2. And in it, it says that we will switch to natural wines. Man, I had switched to Ripple. And that is not one of your natural wines. I don't really think grapes have ever been near it. Probably put some chemicals in a bottle and shook it up real hard and put it on the liquor store shelves in South Central Los Angeles, where I was living at the time with two young children, an 8-year-old daughter and a 9.5-year-old son. And I had drawn the drapes, and I believe I was doomed to die of this disease. I remember those nights sitting in that chair, in that overstuffed chair with a red wig on. Sometimes coming out of blackout and it was on sideways, and hearing the pounding of my heart and feeling that incredible loneliness. When they say alcoholism is a disease of loneliness. And I don't know if you've experienced that kind of loneliness that you could actually physically feel it. But I could hear two children sleeping. And I had to get up and get dressed and get out of there, because it was just too painful sitting there. And I didn't have to go far to the nearest sleazy bar. They were all in walking distance in that area. I don't know, I look back on that now. There was one thing in the area I lived, there was about 7 liquor stores within the radius of a block and a half. The wedge in between that were little storefront churches. It always amazes me that I never stumbled into one of those churches. and wedged in between that was sleazy bars. Not bars of class, and not the kind of classy jazz clubs and environment, of drinking that I had had for many years before I reached that ghetto. And I would crawl up on a stool, I guess feeling like Eleanor Rigby, wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. And it always took a couple of drinks for me to get the courage to say anything to anyone. On my right or on my left, there was always an intellectual sitting there, and I needed a little conversation. And by the end of the evening, we were both legends in our own heads. and I would get out of there somehow, and I was in horrendous blackouts by this time. After that 27, I am a real alcoholic, and after that 27 years of daily drinking, it was at the end of the of that, maybe the 4 or 5 years at the end of that period of my drinking, I was into horrendous blackouts. I don't know how it would happen. Sometimes I would end up spread eagle in the front yard. Maybe it's because I just couldn't get up the steps. And listening to night birds calling each other. Sensing that feeling of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Listening to my heart beat like a rapid drum. And I'd make deals with the God I didn't believe in. But I'd come from the streets in the fast lane, and I knew about making deals. And it was my usual alcoholic prayer, God, if you get me out of this one, you know, I'm just not going to drink anymore. And I'd make those promises and get up off that ground and break them. I always did. Dr. Silkworth, in the front of the big book in the doctor's opinion, who was the wonderful doctor who gave to this fellowship the first step that says we are powerless over alcohol. And the second half of that first step says our lives are unmanageable. And there I stood in the dark hours of the morning, my life totally unmanageable as a result of my alcoholism, and where I was sick of living and scared to die. And I could feel that dampness, and it was always so cold out there, and it always seemed darkest right before dawn. And I don't know about you guys, but in my neighborhood, we had a lady who made it her duty to check on who was going in and out of everybody else's house. And she lived directly across the street from me, and I don't think that lady ever slept. And I could look over at any hour and see her little curtains moving back and forth. And after I get my cool look in the yard, you know, I'd lean over there and I'd give him a finger. Scream across the street, up yours, you know, and stumble up the steps and get through that door and get down the hall and get on my knees and do a few chin-ups on the rim. Chin sliding around waiting for a comfortable place to rest. You know, I passed out in that fetal position. That was my position by that time. You know, the body of a woman in the position of a dying child. And come to and feel that room spinning and trying to stop the spin. The two words that always greeted me was American Standard. I had a perfect view of the bottom of the toilet from the floor up, and then I'd get up off that floor and to get dressed to make the run, and I'd have to break my promise to those kids that I had promised the day before. See that I was going, that Mama was going to stop drinking. And I could look in their eyes when they asked me, you know, about, please, Mama, stop drinking. And I say, I am. I've got to, and I know I will tomorrow. Because my life is all about tomorrow. Get dressed, and I'm living off food stamps and welfare. I had drank away that career, the home, the house, the cars, the vans, the employees, everything was gone. And I never thought I'd stand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and thank God for that. Thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. Because it had come that time in my life when I needed to get sober and I needed to stop dying and I needed to find a God of my understanding. But there I was getting dressed. In South Central Los Angeles, as I said earlier, you don't have to go too far for the nearest liquor store. When you're eating food off of that are bought with food stamps, it's not exactly gourmet food, and you're not worried about your weight because I was 65 pounds overweight. Pull on those tight jeans, put on my bad leather jacket, straighten up that wig, and put on some star-eye earrings that hung to my shoulders. And my mode of transportation by that time was a pair of gold fuzzy house slippers. Tiptoe past the door that I don't want to wake them up because I don't want them to see that look on my face of shame of what my life had become and the guilt and the pain. and get out of that house and sneak down the steps feeling like a thief in the night. Cross that street and pass three houses and lean out in front of the door on Florence. You know, wait for the man to come view the world out of dark glasses. And I always felt the same feeling as I leaned against that door, wondering what happened to all those fair weather friends, the ones I had wined and dined and bought all the love that I could afford. And Bill Wilson, who was a co-founder of our program that I believe was divinely inspired. And in his chapter, he talked about his fair weather friends. Not one showed up on those mornings and said, "Clara, how are you today? What are you going to do about your life?" You see, I learned about caring in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have to know my last name. But you can pick up that phone and you can call me and you ask me how I am today if you know there's something going on in my life that I need some comfort. Out there in those streets, and I, as I said, I know about smiling faces. Because when I sat on those bar stools, the one thing I learned is sometimes that smiling faces often tell lies. And I would wait for the guy to come and trail in there and stand at that counter trying to be cute. I hadn't been cute for a long time. You don't exactly smell too well at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, when you've been drinking Ripple and it's coming out of the pores of your skin, it's not exactly like Chanel number 5. And I wait for him to put the change away and stand there and feel like I'm going to self-destruct. Trying to be cool, and I don't want this man to know that I'm buying this Ripple for me. Some mornings I play games because I knew about the games of life. I just didn't know how to live it. Had never known how to live life from 5 years old. If it was a good morning, I'd play a game. If it was a bad morning, I'd tell them, put that wine in the bag. Sometimes, I don't know about those clerks down there, sometimes they can be real cruel early in the morning. They hold it in the bag, play with the top. You know, and if I started bouncing too much too soon, just reach over and take it out of his hands and pay the 59 cents. I'm into service today. That's the beauty of my life today, in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to give back the gift that was freely given to me. And I was sharing on a panel up in Tehachapi not long ago, and I mentioned the fact that I was wine at that time was 59 cents. And he raised his hand in the back of the room, and he said, "Lady," he said, "I got to tell you something. It's gone up." He said it's $1.18. I thought, well, yeah. I said to him, "Well, I'm glad I quit while I was ahead." So there I was, just out there, you know, like a leaf in a storm. You know, I'd reached that place where I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober and I couldn't stop drinking, and that's called madness. The insanity of this disease, and the fun of drinking was no longer fun. You know, Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And when it worked well, and I had my first drink when I was a student at Boston Museum of Fine Arts, and where I'd been sent to school from Atlanta, Georgia, from a loving family, and I was truly loved. I had great parents, and I didn't know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and doing those steps and doing that fourth step. You know, a lot more was revealed to me about what my perception of them was about. Not only about them, it was about everybody in the world, because people were the enemy. So I had a lot of problems right from the beginning. And when I arrived in Boston, it was going to be different. And I don't know, I'd never seen alcohol because Georgia was a dry state when I grew up in Atlanta. But I came, you know, I always had these secrets. And I heard a man in Alcoholics Anonymous say one night, "We are as thick as our secrets." And my secret was that I wanted to be a performer. And I don't know how I ever got into that one, because my life is always a fantasy about looking at you and wanting what you had but not knowing how you got it. And so I wanted to be a performer. And my parents, said, coming from a very religious Baptist upbringing, wouldn't let me take the classes that I wanted in school, so I went for the art thing. And they said that what I wanted to do was the devil's work. And I had a lot of trouble with God early on. So what I did was I hung out in the movies after I got to that school, because I didn't belong there either. I'm one of those people who for years and years and years, as far back as I can remember, suffered from lack of self-worth and lack of self-esteem, and I always felt inadequate as a human being. So hanging in the moon was in the dark, and I didn't have to account to anyone, and I wouldn't have to let them know how afraid I was. Because fear always motivated my life from as early as I can remember. And if I let you get too close, you might know that. Because if I looked good on the outside, you wouldn't know exactly what was going on the inside. So I played that game for years, you know, looking good. And it almost killed me out there. And I love jazz music, and I thought, God, if I hang in that move and watch people up on the screen in the show business world, it'll rub off on me by osmosis. I am here to tell you that nothing rubs off on you by osmosis, not even Alcoholics Anonymous. In the promises, it said we must work for it. But I thought it would, and it didn't. But I was walking down the street with a student one night, and heard this great jazz music that come out of the door. And I said, just, you know, let's go in there and see what they do. And we walk into this club. It was dimly lit, and the aroma of the cigarette and the booze, and this lady was down at the end of the bar grinding out this soulful music, and I loved it. I immediately had that feeling of living on the edge. And the bartender leaned over as I sat on the stool. He said, what are you going to have to drink? And I didn't know, but I know in the movies they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I had no idea what a dry martini was. He turns around, he puts these two stem glasses up there, and he evened it out. It looked like lemonade. And I didn't know you sip drinks. And I look at it, and I pick it up, and I down it, you know, all in one gulp. I was a pig from the gate. But I remember the way it made me feel. I tell you what that first martini did for me. It quieted the silent screaming that was always going on inside of my head. And I also believe with that drink that the light of my soul began to dim. And 27 years later, in a fetal position on a dirty floor in South Central Los Angeles in the ghetto, the light had gone out. I stepped out on that floor, looked around quickly. You know, I'd never had a friend. I was probably 19 years old. I'd never had a date. Didn't have a clue about relationships. So I got a bunch of people standing around that club. I started dancing. And I mean, it really gave me the courage to perform. And that's what alcohol did for me for all those years. It gave me the courage to perform because it was the outside that performed. It had nothing to do with what was going on the inside. Right away, I got those friends. I call them colorful. The big book calls them law companions. I hooked up with the pimps, the hookers, and the bad boys, and the madams. And I learned real fast how to walk the walk and talk the talk. I was a fast learner in the streets. I still love jazz music. And my favorite jazz artist today is Randy Crawford. And she sings a song about street life. And I relate to the lyrics when she says, if you are young, don't get old in the streets. Because the cold will hit you in the back and your nickel and dime your life away. And you look back one day, it was all a masquerade. Because what you have to do out there is learn to be a role player. So I learned to play the role. I met a young man. We got married. It was the sickest relationship I think the two people could have had. The rocks in his head put the hole in mine. And we stayed in that relationship for 24 years. We had a little son in Boston, and I shoved him off on his grandparents to raise him because I was too busy. There is a part in the big book that describes the kind of alcoholic practicing alcoholic I was when it says selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say we are driven people, and we are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And that's how that was my life. That was the whole thing. I was always, you know, driven by fear. And I could have added to my list ad infinitum. He traveled a lot. I pushed the kid off from the grandparents, and they did a wonderful job. They passed on, and I shall always have loving memories of them. I hung out in those clubs, and I was by that time a star kisser and a jazz and an entourage junkie with all the jazz people around me and hanging out with the great stars. And I met a man, you know, one morning. I was sitting in an after-hour place drinking with Billie Holiday, and And Mr. Wonderful showed up because the husband was out of town. And I was looking for somebody else who was going to fix it. I was always looking for somebody else to fix me, who would take full responsibility for me and my life, because I had no idea how to live it myself. He turned out to be a guy standing in front of me with a black hat on, turned down all the way around, top coat over his shoulders, and he was so cool he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. And he turned out to... I was well into step two by then, and he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the New England family, and what a ride that one was. I believe I came to crossroads in my life, and I invariably would always take the road. It was self-destructive. So I started another lifestyle. And one morning I was being driven home, and I heard a voice say in my mind, "Clara, something's wrong with your life." And I agreed. The problem was Boston. If I could just get out of Boston... get away from the hoods, and I got that husband, picked up that little son that I knew nothing about, because I had stopped visiting him. It was too sad. In my opinion, there is nothing sadder than to look into the eyes of a child when you continue to lie to him because you can't tell him the truth. Dr. Silkworth says, for us alcoholics, there comes a time where we can't differentiate the difference between the truth and the false. And it was easier just to send to a better school and better camps and do that than to look in his eyes that always pained me, and I had no idea how to deal with that. We moved into the Los Angeles area. As a matter of fact, in the West LA near Santa Monica area, I had two other children. Went into a small business right down on Lincoln Boulevard, and that's when I began to drink it all away and go into those horrendous blackouts. That marriage was over because of my violent behavior. I began to end up in hospitals in downtown. In County General, and I ended up in the hospital right about 3 weeks before April the 9th, 1974, one more time in a hospital, not for the treatment of alcoholism, but for being patched up and stitched up for being battered in the streets while under the influence and blackouts. People who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. Lying there in that bed and looking up at people and police, and there was two nuns, an older nun and a young nun, and the older nun stormed out of the window, out of the room, and stood by the window. And I could see her with her back turned because I wouldn't cooperate. The young nun stood there, and I'd come to believe in earth angels. Because never in my life had I seen a face more beautiful, eyes more, like as blue as the heavens, who didn't ask me why didn't I stop drinking, but simply said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" I had no answers for her, and I had a brain concussion from being kicked in the head, and my face looked like a trampoline, and I heard my ribs being cracked one at a time, and I know about pain. I know about physical pain, and I know about emotional pain, and I know that pain has no memory. I was living the life of the jaywalker in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first read that story, illustration of the jaywalker, it seemed absurd. But after a while in sobriety, I looked at that and viewed it very carefully, because that's exactly the life I was living. I kept doing insane things over and over again, expecting a different result. After I got out of that hospital and I came to on that morning, I remember vividly what that morning was like. It was different than hundreds of other mornings that I had to get up from whatever position I was, whether there were strangers in my house. And by that time, I knew faces and I didn't know names. And sometimes it was for the price of cheap wine. But I believe the miracle happened for me that morning. It was my spiritual experience. It took me a while in Alcoholics Anonymous before I realized that is what had happened to me. As I stood in a room and did something I promised I would never do, when I sat on a segregated train out of Atlanta and gave Atlanta the finger, and I would not have to go to that church again that my parents pushed me every time they opened the door. I thought they were a little extreme in the thought that I needed to be in the church every time the door was open. And then I figured, well, you know, I don't have to deal with God because I don't have to be around them anymore. But as I stood in that room, I felt something different. And I remember hearing myself saying, "God, please don't let me die." And Bill Wilson, and he, when he explained his spiritual experience, and he too had been an agnostic, and when he made the phone call, when he questioned his own sanity about what had happened to him, and I guess the good doctor said to him, I don't know what's happened to you, but hang in there because it's better than what you had before. And he summed it up by saying that he felt like the cool wind that was blowing through and through, the clear wind that was blowing through and through. And he summed it up by saying he supposed that God come to most men gradually, but his impact upon him had been sudden and profound. And that was what happened to me, and I stood there in that room and I screamed. Called a friend who told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called that morning, central office, and a man said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, may I help you? And I said, man, my name is Claire and I can't stop drinking, and the truth was finally out. Just that moment of truth made me feel easier. Somehow, I guess what I felt was hope, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. It's about hope. And he said, don't drink today, and he told me where to go to a meeting. It just seemed too simple. Don't drink today. I have learned that Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program for complicated people. And he told me where the meeting was. It was at 2+2 over on Westwood. And I called my brother and I told him I needed a car to go to a meeting. And it was called a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought I'd found a place for me. I had never been able to fit anywhere. I was one of those intellectual drunks that looked for. I was on a search, I'm sure, most of my life. I went to East Indian gurus and I read East Indian philosophies, and I went to encounter groups, and I did it all, and nobody ever told me not to drink just one day. My brother brought his car over, and I'm standing at the door, and he rushed up the stairs, and that family who had loved me so much. I believe my alcoholism had affected the lives of every single person that really loved me. And I remember that older sister, I was trying to borrow the money to save the house, and she looked at me and she said, you know, it pains us to watch you live the way you live, and it frightens us that we might have to see you die. And none of them were alcoholics. I have 7 children. I'm the youngest and I'm the alcoholic. And when I believe that God began to work in their lives for me, because I was couldn't believe that they would not give it to me. They always had. They were about to enable me right to Forest Lawn. But she looked at me and she said, but we will pray for you, and I have come to believe in the power of prayer. And I got in that car that night, and I want to just take a moment to describe what I looked like that day when I was going to be my first day of not having a drink for 27 years. And I didn't know the language in Alcoholics Anonymous, until I got here, about detoxing. And because I'd never had a single person or single friend who had ever gotten sober. And I did not know that it was possible to stop drinking. I did not know that you could get sober. So that was a miracle. And I have come to believe in miracles because they're real. And happen to those who are unafraid to believe in them. So I was that morning around 10 o'clock, the kids were off to school, and those kids, I had lost the will to care. I sat in an overstuffed chair and listened to them fix their own breakfast and fix their own lunch and go off to school without me because I couldn't get out the chair. And so around 10 o'clock, I got a red dress out, on what to wear. Since I didn't know about you guys, I wanted to look good. So I had wine stains on it. So I cleaned up the wine stains and got that wig out, clipped some bangs and kind of sprayed it, and it looked pretty good, And I put it on that head foam, and around 2 o'clock I was bouncing off the wall. I was perspiring like buckets, and I didn't know what was happening for me, but I didn't go down to the liquor store. I went over to Woolworths to browse and just to get out of the house. While I was browsing, I stole some eyelashes. Wanted to add to the glamour. And they come quite long, and I didn't know you're supposed to trim them. And it was an 8 o'clock meeting. At 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, and I got these lashes, and And they come with a little tube of glue. And I'm trying to get the glue along the edge of the lash. And I'm holding my elbow and I'm waiting for an opportune moment. And I slammed the lash in here and one down here, and it was all crooked, and I leaned in the mirror, just too much trouble to try to do it over again. I just said, "You're looking good." And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I sat in that chair, tall Scotty, I think he's still around, I haven't seen him lately, but he greeted me at the door and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous and get yourself a cup of coffee." And it was in those days where we had real cups. And I filled it up too much, and I didn't want you to see me shaking so badly, and I put it down, I sat in the chair, and this is what I believe. That God had etched my name on the chair. And as I sat there and quickly reviewed my life, I realized that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity, had stripped me of all moral values and all family values. And I was sure I was going to die. Gail Wilson was the speaker that night, and it's so important of what we say at this podium, because as a newcomer, I sat there, and when she started to tell her story, I immediately related to the feelings when she talked about the loneliness and she talked about the fear and she talked about things I had never seen, heard anybody talk about before. I got my sponsor that night. She is still my sponsor tonight, and 20 years and 10 months. She's been my friend, my confidant, and my spiritual teacher. She told me to go home and she would call me back and we would... she would tell me what Alcoholics Anonymous was about, and we started this incredible journey. And this journey has been, without a doubt, something I never thought would happen to me in my life. We got into the steps. We did that fourth step. We did that eighth and ninth step. As we got to it, the steps are done in order, 1 through 12. And I'm glad that she pushed me to do all of those steps in that order, but especially the fourth step and the eighth and ninth step, that I cleared up the wreckage of the past with the people that loved me. I made my amends to those children of mine who are all adults. That older son of mine that I couldn't be there for, he passed away last year, the day before the earthquake, of AIDS. He'd done some intravenous drug using, and that, and he is gone, but he left an ex-wife and a little grandson, and God's given me a second chance. That I can be in the life of that little grandson, and I don't make promises to him that I don't keep. When he asked me to go to the park, we go to the park, and I'm glad he's in my life. That I can to give to him what I couldn't give to his dad. mostly go to Toys R Us. I went back into that business when I was 3 years sober, And I want to tell you the miracle of it all. I had gotten a job as a waitress, and I hated that job because I wasn't used to working, but my sponsor made me keep that job. And it was the first place in my whole life that I ever felt any feelings of self-esteem, because I learned how to suit up and show up on a job on time and to give to those employers a full day's work for a full day's pay. And when they said, "You've done a good job," and I would get on that bus, because I still didn't have a car my first year. But it got better. And I want to just share for one moment with you about getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to get well when I was between 3 and 4, and I forgot about standing in front of the liquor store doors. And we talk about the insanity when it returns. And when the book says, the alcoholic at a certain time has no effective mental defense against the first drink, and that it must come from a higher power. That defense must come from a higher power. And when I was, dancing around my room, I bought a little house I still live in, and I had this nice car, and I had a call from central office. And it was the beginning of a new beginning in my relationship and what I have found that this disease is about. And I was asked by central office to go on a 12-step called the Skid Row, and I didn't want to do it because life was getting to be too good again for me, and it's so easy to forget the insanity that returns. And I didn't want to do it, but the woman got really annoyed with me. She said, "Oh, stop it." She said, just take the information. And it was at a time when I had heard you never turned down an AA request. And I called my sponsor so I could just kind of get her to talk me out of it. And I told her this whole story about this girl named Dorothy in a Skid Row hotel down on Skid Row. And I said, and I get no response. She said, I said to her, I don't want to do it. She said, I don't care what you don't want to do. You do it anyway. And she hung up. So then I heard, you never go on a 12-step call alone. So I called this little actress. She had about 90 days at the time. And I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She said, where? I said, it's down on Skid Row. She said, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you want to do. And we went downtown and we made a 12-step call on Dorothy. And I walked into a filthy room and a 21-year-old young woman dying on her own vomit. And that was the beginning, because something changed with me. It was indeed the 12th step, and it was indeed a spiritual awakening. And I don't know if she ever stayed sober, and I don't know where she is tonight, but I believe God put her in my life because God had some purpose for me in my life. And it's from that beginning, you know, I have been in complete service. That's my life. The rest of it is just the trimmings of what I work and do on a daily basis. I am blessed to be sober. And every morning on my knees for that God that I come to believe in, I ask God to let me be a channel in some way to give back this gift to someone he's trying to reach. And with that, you know, I have another day of freedom, and I have another day of peace, exactly what the promise to all of us. Doesn't matter how far down the scale I've gone. There's freedom in my life today, and I can share that with you if we can help. It's rooms like this that you rendered me sober and you rendered me sane, and for that I am eternally grateful. Thank you.